Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 17, 2019. Former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is in Khobar prison.
He says he doesn't believe that Bashir is in prison. And even if he's in prison, they want a trial for Bashir and his people.
And the Ugandan government offers asylum to Omar al-Bashir.
If President Omar al-Bashir applies for asylum in Uganda, that is a matter that can be considered by the President of Uganda.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Media reports are quoting relatives of former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir as saying the ousted leader has been moved from house arrest to Khobar prison in Khartoum. Protesters who are demanding for a civilian government are skeptical. Naba Mohyeddin reports from Khartoum.
Reports on Wednesday state the ousted former president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, has been moved from house arrest to federal prison. Unnamed members of Bashir's family told Reuters news agency, the BBC, and others he was moved to Khobar prison in Khartoum late Tuesday, while prison guards told CNN they saw Bashir's arrival at the facility. Khobar prison is where Bashir locked up many of his opponents during his 3 decades in power. But some of the thousands of protesters remaining camped outside the defense ministry since last Thursday coup are skeptical. Protester Abu Bakr Ali says there should be proof that the former president was arrested. He says he doesn't believe that Bashir is in prison, and even if he's in prison, they want a trial for Bashir and his people. The Sudanese Professional Association, the main protest group, also voiced doubts. Muhammad Abbas is with the SPA. He said the news remains unconfirmed unless the military council announces it in a press conference. People in the streets and the sit-in are demanding to see photos of the arrest on national TV as well, adds Abbas. A well-placed source told VOA Wednesday the reports of Bashir's move to the prison were not true and that he was still being held under house arrest. The protesters have been demanding a return to civilian rule since the military announced Bashir was moved from power and a council would rule Sudan for 2 years before elections. Protesters and the international community are pressing the military for a quicker return to civilian government. The African Union on Monday threatened to freeze Sudan's membership if they don't return civilian rule within 2 weeks. The European Union echoed that sentiment on Tuesday, refusing to recognize Sudan's military council and arguing a civilian transitional government. But not all protest groups are demanding the military be sidelined. Sudan's Gathering of Unionists in Opposition Party said it would be happy if the military council simply included civilians. Hashim Babikir is a spokesman of the party. He says their vision in the party is to form a presidential council with civilians, but they don't mind the military representation as well to protect the demands of the revolution. The SBA called for bigger protests in Sudan starting Thursday until the military council hands over power to an elected and qualified civilian government. Sudan's protests erupted in December over fuel and food shortages, then quickly escalated to massive street protests calling for Bashir to step down. Naba Mohyeddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Uganda says it will consider giving asylum to Sudan's former president Omar al-Bashir, who was toppled by the military last week. A Ugandan human rights activist says the offer is an insult to people who suffered atrocities at the hands of Bashir's government. Halima Athumani reports for VOA from Kampala.
Okello Riem, Uganda's State Minister for Foreign Affairs, said Tuesday that Uganda might take in Sudan's ousted president.
If President Omar al-Bashir applies for asylum in Uganda, that is a matter that can be considered by the President of Uganda.
Oriem, speaking Wednesday to VOA, said Uganda will not be apologetic to anybody if Bashir decided to come to the country. He also said Uganda does not recognize the International Criminal Court, or ICC, which in 2009 issued a warrant for Bashir's arrest on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide in Sudan's Darfur region. The head of the International Center for Transitional Justice in Uganda, Sarah Kasande, says Oryem's statement is regrettable and an insult to Bashir's victims. Kasande notes Uganda ratified the Rome Statute, which established the ICC, and says Uganda is legally obliged to arrest and surrender Bashir should he enter the country. But, she stresses, the 1951 Refugee Convention, which Uganda also signed, does not allow Bashir enter the country.
Article 1F, it clearly excludes persons who are accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity from being granted asylum or refugee status. The same provision is contained in our Refugee Act. Section 5 disqualifies persons who are accused of such heinous crimes from benefiting from asylum.
If anything, Kasanda believes Uganda should prosecute Bashir, who it once accused of backing Lord's Resistance Army rebel leader Joseph Kony. The LRA killed tens of thousands in northern Uganda before moving westward into Congo.
They still have an obligation to prosecute him. How and whether they'll do that is another matter. But either way, he should face justice. But also, I find it quite disturbing that Uganda would dangle asylum to Bashir. He hasn't asked for asylum from Uganda. It is upon the people of Sudan to determine what happens to the fate of their ex-dictator.
For the time being, Bashir is reportedly being held at a maximum security prison after initially being put under house arrest. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
During a regularly scheduled UN Security Council meeting on Darfur today, British Representative Jonathan Allen took a moment to comment on the Sudanese popular call for an inclusive government as well as demands to hold their former leaders accountable.
We believe that there must be justice for the crimes committed by individuals within the former government of Sudan. It is right that the Sudanese people should hold those individuals accountable. Of course, we fully support the International Criminal Court and expect full cooperation by all states with the court and its prosecutor.
Allen says the Sudanese people have forced change in their country, but there is much more work that lies ahead.
Sudan is at a crossroads. The Transitional Military Council faces a choice. It should listen to the Sudanese people, respect their legitimate demand for civilian rule, and enable the transition to a system which respects human rights, democracy, and fundamental freedoms, and delivers accountability.
Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Deputy Emergency Relief Coordinator Usral Maula also addressed the council in New York today. She says the Sudan's economic crisis has impacted Darfur as well, adding that the number of people needing humanitarian assistance has grown. British Ambassador Allen echoed those remarks during his time.
It is vital for the future stability of Darfur, but also wider Sudan and the region, that we as a council maintain our expectation that progress is made in finding a peaceful solution to the root causes of the conflict.
Mueller added that humanitarian partners are appealing for $1.1 billion to assist 4.4 million people across Sudan, which represents a bit of more than half of the overall needs identified in the country, including 2.4 million people in Darfur. Ammar Yusuf, leader of the Sudanese Professional Association, which has been a driving force in the protest movement, stressed that the sit-in is the only guarantee to meet the public's demand. Those include a transitional civilian-led government and the abolition of laws restricting freedoms. The African Union has threatened to suspend Sudan's membership if the military council does not transfer power to a civilian government within 2 weeks. Paul Nantulai, an analyst and a researcher at the National Defense University's Africa Center for Strategic Studies, weighs in on whether such pressure would force the military to give in to the demands of the protesters.
It depends on a number of things. One, the African Union is trying to enforce a long-standing policy that is intolerant to what they call unconstitutional changes of government. And so this would constitute one such change. Secondly, the success will depend on how united and how much consensus the rest of the international community is able to bring to bear. The other influencing factor will be the calculations that the military leadership will play itself. Now, indications are that the Sudanese armed forces, as currently structured, certainly at the leadership level, is not united. There are factions, you know, that are vying for power within the military, and the military as an institution is not completely decided 100% on which way Sudan should go. The third dynamic, of course, will be the protesters on the ground and the ability of the Sudan Professionals Association, together with its coalitions around the country, to apply political pressure to basically push the parties forward around this goal that they have articulated, which is that the power must transfer to civilian authority.
The Sudanese Association of Professionals called for disbanding the military council and form a civilian transitional council. Is that a possible scenario?
It could. It is a scenario. It's important to note that the Sudan Professionals Association is not an organization that emerged last night or last week. They've been around for some time. And some of their members were involved in previous peaceful insurrections against military governments. We had a process in 1985 that removed Jafar Nimeiri. We had a process in 1964 that removed the government of General Aboud. So what the SPA coalitions have said is that they are rooted, they remember that experience. Secondly, we have seen them lead the trade union movement for many, 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 many years. And one of the decisions they took in 2010 and 2011 is that they would organize professionals, they would organize across interfaith lines, they would organize across the trade union movement, they would organize across the broader structures of civil society to be able to craft a vision of what a democratic Sudan should look like. They have put forward this vision. They have transitional proposals and documents that they've been working on for many, many, many years. These protesters are not rioting because they want food. They're rioting because they want to implement a vision for democracy in the Sudan that they have held for many, many years. One can argue going all the way back to 1964. So it's important to understand the organic roots of this movement and to understand the kind of transition that they are calling for.
Is there any chance that the deep state in Sudan would win and repeat the same Egyptian scenario?
It's a possibility. The military could decide to hang on, or sections of the military could decide to hang on because it's by no means cohesive. They could yield to the demands of the SPA and its coalitions, or the SPA and the military could meet each other halfway.
That was Paul Nantulai from the National Defense University's Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashinawi. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, peace monitoring officials are in Yei Town to see the progress in the implementation of South Sudan's peace agreement. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
name something that you haven't tried but hope to someday.
I never drive a car, but I opt to because I've grown in a poor background, and in my life I desire to do so.
I want to travel from Uganda to a different country because I've never moved out of Uganda. Yes.
I've never tried bungee jumping, but I would like to try it one time.
I've not tried paragliding before, but I would like to try it someday, being at the top of the mountain, jumping and flying the sky like a bird.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Leaders of South Sudan's peace monitoring bodies are in Yei Town to discuss progress and the challenges facing the implementation of the September revitalized peace agreement in Yei River State. Daniel Martin Friday reports for VOA from Yei Town.
IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan, Ismail Waris, Army's Chief David Shearer, and the acting chairperson of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission met with Yei River State Government and SPLA-IO officials to encourage the parties to end the violence and implement the peace deal. Agostino Jorogi, the acting chairperson of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, is urging state officials to engage in dialogue with rebels of the National Salvation Front to end ongoing fighting in the state.
Unfortunately, for the people of Yei, they are not seeing any peace because of this problem. But the other places, there is no fighting. I wish to urge you to talk to the commanders, even of those, whether it is SOA or IO or SSPDF, you should probably look for a way of convincing the leaders of NAS that it is time to join the others in this peace agreement.
Jorogi says JEMEC will speak with the leader of NAS or National Salvation Front, General Thomas Cirillo, to join the peace process in South Sudan. NAS spokesman Suba Samuel Manas says although their movement believes in ending the conflict through dialogue, the government still engages in a military approach. Lam Paul Gabriel, the deputy military spokesman for the SPLA-IO, describes the meeting with the peace partners as fruitful. IGAD Special Envoy Ismail Wise says he is in Yei to collect more data about how the peace process is being implemented in the area.
We are in a very critical position now about the peace process, and we were here really to talk to the authorities and the people here in the region to find out how peace is implemented and what challenge they are facing. We have gathered a lot of good information, and we will continue doing this.
Humanitarian organizations operating in Yei River State accused government and SPLA-IO forces of denying access to humanitarian organizations trying to deliver assistance to people in the rural parts of the state. David Shearer, the special representative of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, says Yei River State faces numerous challenges.
We discussed a number of the issues that are of Yei River State, including the cantonment, also the issue of accessibility around Yei River State as well, and the general cooperation. I mean, obviously there's some challenges here, challenges with regard to the ongoing fighting, although we've seen that. But the UN wanted very much to push forward with as much as we can with our patrolling to give people the confidence that they need to start moving back. Having Yei River State normalized and people moving back and starting to farm again.
Yei River State Governor Emmanuel Adil claims the security situation across the state remains stable and many families are returning back to their villages. Adil says the state government is committed to peace building to end the suffering of the civil population. Less than a month from now, on May 12, South Sudan's warring parties are expected to form a transitional government of national unity that is supposed to last for 3 years. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin, reporting from Yei Town.
South Sudan government, SPLA-IO rebels and community leaders from Wau State have appealed to donors to support recovery programs in Wau. The leaders say there is a relative calm in the area after the revitalized peace agreement was signed last year, and farmers are ready to grow their own food once again. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Wau Town.
The appeal was made on Tuesday during a joint meeting between donors and community leaders in Wau to express their concern about the humanitarian situation in Wau State. Community leaders say the 5-year conflict has hindered several development projects in Wau. Wau women's rights activist Sabila Sabit says many women have suffered sexual exploitation, including women with disabilities, who, she says, are in dire need of help.
Some of them are victims of the current crisis that happened in South Sudan. Some of them are naturally born that way. But how can we bring them in? Somebody who is blind and the person has 3 kids, 4 kids, to find that the father is not there. Where is she getting the kids from? That is a sexual abuse.
17-year-old Gao Bol Gao, a senior 4 student at the Standard Secondary School in Wau, says the conflict has prevented many of his friends from continuing their studies. Gao says the time has come for government officials to build schools, especially for girls.
This conflict have made us to remain behind. But since we have seen there are people who care and they want to see that our resources are utilized, we are committed and we want to join our hands together and make sure that our resources are utilized for our people and for our state.
Wau State Governor Angelo Taban Biagio says the people of Wau have suffered long enough during the conflict. He assured donors that his government is working closely with opposition representatives in the area and urged donors to support local initiatives in the state.
We need to work hard to grow our own food, pay our children to school, provide livelihood opportunity for our youth and women, and reclaim our position as a development of Barangazal region.
Alian Nodehu, heads of the humanitarian office at the United Nations mission in South Sudan, led the delegation to Wau. Nodehu expressed a willingness to support recovery programs in Wau if there is a genuine peace.
They want to start now rebuild their communities, and what they're looking for is a partner or somebody who can actually assist them. Now we have UN agencies, donors, NGOs. We have committed ourselves to support people who want to rebuild their life. We will support people who want to resilience. So the question now is, look at what concrete proposal they are having.
Donor communities who attended the meeting include officials from the European Union, the Netherlands, Germany, and USAID, among others. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
Hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese children could face malnutrition this year. That's according to the International Rescue Committee. Humanitarian activist and Hollywood actress Mia Farrow says she witnessed how IRC is training community health workers to respond to the needs of families in the former Unity State.
These community health care workers, what they told me, every single woman that I spoke to, and these are really heroic women, expressed the desire, the need, the fervent desire to be able to treat malnutrition as well, acute malnutrition, all levels of malnutrition. And this they could do. But for this arcane setup, which actually, I mean, it doesn't even make sense. Why wouldn't communities be able to address, especially these women who are so ably trained? I mean, I watched one of these community health workers test for malaria. She diagnosed this sick, feverish baby, and was able to give the appropriate medicine as well.
I know what you're saying. It has been confirmed by many of our different reporters in Jonglei State and Unity State and Wau State, where these women especially walk for days and days in that extreme heat. But like mothers anywhere around the world, they'll do anything for their children. And
it's cruel to continue a process that I think it's a moral imperative to implement this and bring the peanut-based nutrients to the children rather than have the babies brought to a clinic that may or may not exist on a journey they may or may not survive. Because it's dangerous no matter which way you look at it. I mean, it's a war-torn country. It's not a safe place anyway. And then there's the elements, and then there's the malnutrition. There's acute malnutrition. So you've got a very, very ill baby and very possibly an ill mother, too. And can you imagine such a walk? And I'm really eager because it will require those agencies, the UN agencies, WFP, World Food Program, and UNICEF, to. We need them to feel as enthusiastic as we are and get behind this.
That was actress Mia Farrow, the spokesperson of the International Rescue Committee, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme last week. A coordinator of a local non-profit organization in Juba says South Sudan should construct a safe house for women and girls who are survivors of gender-based violence. Sarah Beji says the government has no facility to protect victims of domestic violence, forcing many women and girls who have experienced violence to remain silent. ONN Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
The non-profit network for AIDS service organization in South Sudan helps women survivors of violence who are beaten by men. Sarah Beja directs the programs for treating victims of gender-based violence. She says South Sudanese victims of violence need a safe place to go where they can recover.
The safe house we are thinking about is for government-owned. Even a women's organization can have a safe house. even like to allow the church, for instance, to have a safe house. And maybe the intimate partner violence, sometimes because he's angry with the mother, can even decide to leave this children attached to her. So these children also need safety. You cannot just take the mother for treatment. She's admitted in the hospital for 1 week, for instance. And then what happens to the children? Where are you going to leave them?
Abeja says violence against women and girls in South Sudan has become a human rights issue.
The last 2 weeks, we rescued 3 survivors of domestic violence, of which we had to take them to the hospital. They were treated, and after treatment, they had to go back to their families, and yet that is where the violence happened. So with that in place, it is very minimal that these women are protected once they go back to their families.
Abeja says it's a threat for her organization to expose and help survivors of violence. Awudeng Achuil, Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare, says she's shocked by the number of reports of violence against women and girls in South Sudan.
Culturally, a child is for everybody in the community to protect and see its well-being, and particularly women and girls, because we all grew up among our communities. I grew up in a village where I walked through the bushes, but I was never attacked after today. So there's something new that has come that we need to look at it seriously.
Father John Ochaya, a Catholic chaplain at Juba Prison, says South Sudanese leaders should address gender-based violence and they don't need money to do it.
There are other things that we can do without money. It is our own problem. Can we not begin from the scratch, especially post-war? Don't ask things from outside. You begin from here.
Bex Buckingham is the country director of the Department for International Development in South Sudan. Buckingham says the world is committed to eliminating all forms of violence against women and girls by the year 2030.
Research conducted in South Sudan as part of DFID's What Works program found that up to 73% of women and girls in our study had experienced violence at the hand of their partner. This violence devastates lives.
Buckingham says South Sudan's peace agreement provides hope for a new beginning. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
That report by Onen Walter Solomon from Juba brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Halina Shtakal by Lomerika San. We have been listening to Lomerika San with the song Halina Shtakal. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
nesibu shoko kasilani ya kona
Hey, nice
Keni nesibu duku kasumagu wa taketi ya kona
Hey,